House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2017. The first item on the agenda is an informational meeting on the Student Threat Assessment Systems and School Safety Tip Line. Call Sheriff Roberts, Superintendent Hampton, and William Moduleski, please.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, I'm Clackamas County Sheriff Craig Roberts, and I'm appearing today as the chair of the Oregon Task Force on School Safety to update you on the recommendations of the task force to make our schools safer. With me is Superintendent Travis Hampton, who will update you on the Safe Oregon and the new student tip line we're excited to talk about today. We will also introduce what the task force recommends as the next critical steps to prevent school violence before it happens. A statewide student threat assessment system for all Oregon schools, and I'd also like to call the system oftentimes safety net for students and schools. Here today to talk about the specifics of the assessment are three panelists we're thrilled to have with us. School Safety Task Force Vice Chair Dr. Dave Novotny will address the task force statewide proposal. William Moduleski, school violence prevention expert, will address the history of threat assessment and how it works as a proven violence intervention strategy. And then also we have with us Sergeant Kevin McDonald, a school resource officer with Beaverton Police Department, will provide examples of how the assessment can actually save lives. To take you back, in 2014, the Oregon Task Force on School Safety was formed because of the leadership of the House Judiciary Committee. The task force was initially comprised of members from law enforcement and education. However, we really quickly realized that we needed to partner with folks from mental health and the Department of Education at the table as well. Those positions were added in 2016. And in 2017, we recommended adding a member from the Oregon Health Authority on Suicide Intervention Program. And that's Ann Kirkwood, currently serves in that role. She's here today as well. And she's been attending the task force meetings for the past year. I can't tell you enough how having Ms. Kirkwood at the table has been very important to understanding how to assess and how we can address Oregon youth suicide crisis we're facing in our state. When the task force first met in 2014, we were focused on responding to active shooter situations. However, as we looked at best practice nationally, we quickly realized that prevention on active shooter situations needed to be our first goal. Our task force unanimously agreed that this needs to be a priority. The Oregon Task Force needs an effective strategy to stop violence before it occurs, and that's really what this task force has been focused on. A statewide threat assessment is that strategy. Well, in 2015, the task force issued a report to the legislature that identifies several key steps to respond to school violence. Establish standardized terminology for emergency response and school safety drills. That was accomplished by House Bill 2621 in 2015. Establish and fund a statewide tip line for anonymous threats of harm. That was accomplished by House Bill 4075 in 2016. And now establish and fund a statewide threat assessment system to help schools, help students who exhibit violent or suicidal intentions. And that brings us to today's presentation. Before I introduce Superintendent Hampton to talk about the Safe Oregon tip line, I want to make the point clear that the tip line and the threat assessment are really meant to go together hand in glove and to prevent violence and suicide. The tip line provides an anonymous system for folks to report threats of harm and also threats of self-harm. The assessment system helps schools respond to those threats with the assistance of really a MDT or multidisciplinary team. And I think about this assessment as truly a safety net for our youth. It intervenes to prevent harm, and it ensures services are provided to change behavior. Together with the tip line and the assessment, we can not only save lives, but it will change lives. And I now would like to introduce Travis Hampton. And just before I do that, I just wanted to really give him some accolades, because ever since he stepped in as the role of Superintendent of State Police, he has truly hit the ground running. This is a priority for him, and we couldn't be more fortunate on the task force to have Travis Hampton leading the charge on this. So, Superintendent Hampton.
Thank you, Chair, for the introduction. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Travis Hampton. I'm a Superintendent of State Police. Thank you so much for that introduction. OSP does prize and value its role in implementing the Safe School Recommendations, implementation of the tip line named Safe Oregon. I know there's a lot to cover today in today's informational hearing. We want to talk threat assessment. Some speakers I'm excited to hear from, too. So in the interest of time, submitted a question and answer sheet on some talking points on Safe Oregon, the origin with House Bill 4075, the implementation, the cost, the duration of the contract. So I just want to give a quick snapshot of where we are today. OSP and the members of the task force recognize that kids in schools today communicate very differently than we do, than we did when we were their age. I made a joke before the meeting talking to colleagues that I could probably take my phone and call my two teenage daughters now and the phone to ring until my battery goes dead. But if I want to connect with them via social network or a form of communication that they're used to communicating with, it'd be moments, seconds. So OSP realized that we had to deliver that same opportunity to Oregon school kids to communicate, report abuse, bullying, harassment, threats of self-harm through not only phone calls that we're accustomed to, or person-to-person contact, but text messaging, mobile application, the ability to deliver screenshots, video. It has to be confidential, and it has to be consistent. So OSP did enter into a five-year contract with a private vendor where these tips will come in through one of these methods of communication. They're triaged by professionals that know what type of calls are a 911 call, the police type of call, are down to rumors or maybe school policy violations that will be reported to the school authority and or in some cases law enforcement. Big challenge to first provide the service to all K through 12 students in the state, over 500,000 students. I'm happy to say report that OSP did deliver this product. We launched the Safe Oregon tip line on January 31st. And before I go any further, I just want to give credit where credit is due. We've had two people that have been instrumental in developing not only the vendor, but going out statewide to pilot the project and champion the project. And that is our project manager, Jody Sherwood, sitting behind me, and Rebecca David, who is our operations director of our public safety bureau. So credit where credit is due. We've had essentially 1.5 employees working on this project to deliver it statewide. So through their hard work, as of this morning, Jody, project manager Sherwood, let me know that we now have 145 schools signed up from 53 Oregon cities, representing over 50,000 students. And I'd just like to close my brief presentation with some feedback we received from a school principal. This is a little bit clunky, this quote I'm about to read, because it's been redacted to protect the identity of the students and the school. But I think it speaks volumes for how effective the tip line is so far. In the 2 weeks since our launch of Safe Oregon, we received 20 reports. 18 have been legitimate, including bullying, suicidal feelings, sexual harassment, and drug use. Action taken has ranged from consultation with law enforcement, suspensions, or counseling the student or group of students. In one particular instance, a girl posting suicidal thoughts on social media was reported. Safe Oregon called school administration and the police were involved. The girl was taken to the hospital for evaluation, potentially saving her life. Another student reported her friend was being bullied. The victim came up to me later, gave me a hug, and thanked me for protecting and supporting him. During lunch, students can be heard casually talking about Safe Oregon. Students don't always have the maturity or support to navigate a situation alone. Safe Oregon has provided our students the opportunity to feel safe so they can be ready to learn at high levels and be a contributing member of our school community. That's from a school principal in Oregon that's part of the Safe Oregon program. So I just wanted to supply that illustration, and I appreciate your time today.
Yes, next I'd like to introduce William Maleski, school violence prevention expert. And Mr. Maleski will be our keynote speaker this evening at this school safety briefing at the Police Academy this evening. Hope you can join us. Just to tell you quickly about him, he spent 40 years in public service, including 20 years as a senior leader at the United States Department of Education. It is a true honor to have him here in Oregon, and we appreciate him coming here to present to you today, sir.
Thank you very much, Sheriff, Representative Barker, and members of the committee. Thank you very much for inviting me here this afternoon to present testimony. We're presenting it on an issue that is...
You need to identify yourself for the record, just by name.
Okay. William Modzelewski.
Thank you.
Okay. An issue that should be part of every school safety plan, that is a multidisciplinary threat assessment team that identifies and provide services to those that are on a pathway to behavior that would cause harm to self or others. And when I say cause harm to self, I'm talking primarily about suicides. I've been involved, as the sheriff says, for 40 years on issues related to safe schools, school safety, children and youth. Been involved in dealing with natural disasters, floods, shootings, I should say floods, fires and tornadoes, man-made disasters, shootings, serial suicides, medical disasters such as the spread of H1N1 and the rural of schools and that. And I think the one issue, or I should say the one item that basically it really, when I look back at the experience that really stands out is the experience that we've had with the United States Secret Service. That partnership with the Secret Service in 1999 and 2000 led to the development of two reports. One report is this, called The Threat Assessment in Schools, a Guide to Managing Threatening Situations, Creating Safe School Climates. And the other was the Safe School, Safe School Initiative, which dealt with looking at and examining 41 persons who went into schools and committed targeted attacks on those schools. I want to today to focus on the latter publication, the Threat Assessment Manual, and explicitly to answer two questions. One is the what is threat assessment, and two is why should schools engage in threat assessment? Basically, threat assessment is a process to, as I mentioned, to identify persons on a pathway to engage in violent acts to others or to self, and to provide those persons with services before they engage in that act. And that issue about providing services is important because that's what differentiates it from a lot of other things. It's stopping people, it's providing services and hope to get back into a normative behavior. It's made up of three parts. The first part is the identification of individuals of concern, that is, others who make threats to selves or others. And this, by the way, is where the tip line could come in. You know, I am just ecstatic about this because a lot of places that have threat assessment teams don't have a way to basically gain information. And threat the tip line is a way. You know, what we say is that information is the lifeblood of a threat assessment program, and this really helps drive the overall threat assessment program. Second is to assess the threat. To gauge the type of services that's needed. That's, again, that's the core part. That's the essential part of a threat assessment team. And three, the part which, as I look around the country and deal with schools around the country on threat assessment, which is lacking in a lot of parts, is what we call managing this situation. It's very easy to pull somebody in, to identify them and say, hey, here's the services you need, and then they drop the ball. They don't manage it. They don't follow up on it. So it has to be three parts. And we find that if you want a successful threat assessment team, it's dependent upon a host of factors. One, it's non-adversarial. This is not a gotcha program. We're looking to make arrests. We're looking to put persons in a justice system. It's basically to help persons. Two, there has to be a commitment to the process. If the principal doesn't support it, if the superintendent doesn't support it, if the district doesn't support it, it's not going to work. Three is that it has to have the confidence of students. You know, we also did a complementary study called the bystander study, and what we are interested in is why did people who knew about school shootings not come forward? And over again, what we heard was there wasn't confidence in basically reporting it to a school, and so you need the confidence of the school. The ability to attract a committed staff. You know, this is not going to work with just anybody picking them out and saying, do this. You need a committed staff. An agreement to share information. As I mentioned, information is the lifeblood. And if we don't have that willingness to share information, threat assessment's not going to work. Has adequate resources to refer persons to. That gets back to that third step. You know, we need more mental health. We need health, mental health, child services. And so as we're assessing these persons, and we can make all the recommendations we want, but if those services aren't there, it's not going to work. And lastly, it focuses on behaviors and not characteristics. What I mean by this is that it's not a process which merely says is because somebody looks a certain way, has tattoos, wears a trench coat or whatever that has certain markings on them. That's not what we're about. We're looking at what are those behaviors that causes us alarm. And so it's really behavioral based. Next, I want to say is why threat assessment? You know, why did the Department of Education in 2001, 2002 wake up and say we need a threat assessment process? You know, in order to understand why we have threat assessment, we really got to go back to the 1990s. And it seemed like every month there was a school shooting that resulted in multiple victims. Pearl, Mississippi, Paducah, Kentucky, Moses Lake, Jonesboro, and even here in Springfield, Oregon. Kip Kinkle walks into a school the day after he kills both of his parents and kills two more individuals. And that all culminated in April 20th, 1999, of Columbine. And I think that after Columbine, all of us at federal level, state level, local level, whether we're in education, whether in a justice system, we're scratching our heads and beginning to say is, what the hell do we do about this? You know, what are we going to do? And, you know, there were a couple roads we could go down. Road one was, let's do more of the same. We knew that that wasn't going to work. Road two is saying, let's just put more law enforcement in there. We could, you know, we'll put more cops in every school that there is, and we'll do that. We knew that also wouldn't work. It may work for a little while, but it's not sustainable, nor is it really good for schools. The third is more security, more metal detectors, or whatever the case may be. And we also knew that that wasn't going to work. We knew that the answer was prevention. We knew that the answer was early intervention. And we also knew that the answer probably is something we weren't really looking at. At that point in time, we heard a knock on a door, and a Secret Service director came in with his staff and said, you know, we, meaning the U.S. Secret Service, just finished the study. It was called the Exceptional Case Study. It was a study conducted by the Secret Service to identify persons who made threats against their protectees. And basically not only made threats, but basically whether you could distinguish those threats, which threats were really serious, which versus those threats were not so serious. What they found is that they were categorizing every threat in the same way. Every threat had to be investigated the same way. Resources had to be handled the same way, while they knew for a fact that not every threat was similar. And so what they said to the Secretary of Education at that time is, you know, we think that we could use the process that we developed for our study to identify youth that have gone into a school and committed these targeted attacks against schools. And we think that it'll take us a little while, but at the end of the day, we could find out, number one, why they did it and what we need to do to prevent those attacks from occurring. Well, it took the Secretary of Education about 30 seconds to basically say, yes, let's do that. He said there was, you know, only one provision, and that provision is that this is not done solely by law enforcement, but this is done in a partnership of education and law enforcement. And the director, Mark Stafford, at that time said, look, we wouldn't have it any other way. This is the way it has to work. And that began a study that basically lasted 2 years. We looked at 41 individuals, 37 cases. We examined arrest records. We expanded where there was a trial records, law enforcement records. We interviewed, where possible, the offenders themselves in prisons around the United States. And we had 10 findings. I'm not going to mention them all, but key among the findings were, one, the shootings were not impulsive. What does that mean? It means that basically Johnny or Joe didn't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to go to school and basically commit these shootings. What it meant was that there was planning involved. There was a planning, there was an ideation, there were plans, there was assessing of weapons, and there was their event. That was critical because that in itself is sort of where the basis of threat assessment came from. If we could stop that youth who's on the trajectory to harm, we could do good. We could stop that. So that's number one. Two, what we found out in most of these cases is that other people knew. This wasn't basically Johnny acting in isolation. I mean, he had friends. Remember, all of these cases we looked at, there were boys. All of them were adolescent boys. And if you begin to look at the psychology of that, is they talk to other people. So other people knew, and they joined in the planning of the attack.
Third is, others were concerned. What we identified and found out is that, you know, these kids did not fall through the cracks. These weren't kids who basically nobody knew. Matter of fact, most of these kids were known by large numbers of people, but they just didn't do anything about it. No profile. You know, I think that this is one of those which everybody would want to see. It would have been simple if we could say we're looking for a profile. Person has to be male, has to be of certain height and certain weight and look a certain way and have certain grades and have a certain family. But all of that was wrong. All of our cases were different. They were very, very different. Successful kids, unsuccessful kids. Intact family, no family. Use of drugs, no drugs. So no profile whatsoever. And last, felt bullied. You know, about 75% of our kids basically said to us when we looked at them is that they were bullied in school. Now, it's hard to look at education records and find out whether they were bullied or not, but it gets back to the perception. If these kids felt they were bullied, they were being bullied. Bullied played a very big part in the school shootings. And lastly is that there were difficulties with loss. And by this I mean is that these kids had a loss of standing, they had a loss of girlfriend, boyfriend, education, but they did experience loss. Loss led to depression in many cases. 7 people in our study basically committed suicide as they engaged in this. So there was a tie-in between suicidal thoughts and the homicides. So these findings really served as the foundation for the threat assessment. So we, you know, embraced the concept that the Secret Service developed, their threat assessment process, and made modifications to it. And we embraced the concept and said, you know, several reasons why we need to go down this path. First is, first and foremost, because when used properly, and I want to underscore that, when done properly, because properly plays a big part of this here, is it can prevent certain acts of violence, including suicide, from occurring. So if your threat assessment gets the information in a timely basis, if they act on that information through leakage or whatever, and they get the resources, they get law enforcement involved, they get mental health involved, they get the family involved, they get friends involved, is that we could prevent a great deal of violence behavior from occurring. Second, we could reduce the trauma associated with violent deaths. One of the things that struck us is that any time there's a death, whether it's a multiple death or a single death, whether it's a suicide or a shooting or an accidental death, there's a significant amount of trauma that's created in the home, in the family, in the community, and indeed when we look at some of these large-scale attacks such as in Columbine or Sandy Hook in the nation itself. And that trauma has significant effects and impacts on behavior, on education, and on learning. Third is that there's evidence that it could reduce behaviors that lead to poor performance in school and entry into the justice system. Again, if done properly, that assessment, that middle part, you know, where you're doing the assessment, that threat assessment team could make recommendations which sets this kid on the straight and narrow, where we don't have to basically introduce him into the justice system. He could say, hey, you know, we need to provide these services. And these are the services we're going to provide. So it serves as a directional, you know, moving that person in the right direction. Fourth, it has a potential for bringing service providers together. And this is one we often overlook. It's essentially saying is let's move out of our silos. You know, we need mental health worker. Well, who's providing it in the community? Well, let's basically talk to 5 people and let's pick somebody. And in this day and age, when services are limited, when dollars for services are very limited, this becomes a very strategic role for threat assessment team to play. Is because what they're struggling to do is to knock down those walls, those barriers, and basically identify who to go to and what are the services to provide. And the threat assessment can do that. Lastly, it's flexible enough. What I like to say is that, look, we never set up a process in Washington that said, hey, everybody in all states, 15,000 school districts in this country, all 15,000 school districts have to follow the same model. No, it's not. It's not what we said. There's key principles that they need to follow. But if one district wants to basically go in this direction and take just violent acts which relate to shootings, the next one wants to include suicide, the next one wants to include bullying and other things, that's a local decision which really needs to be made. I think the structure is there for locals to make a decision of basically about what they want to take on. I should say as an aside is that the FBI just released the report on combating violent extremism, and the first recommendation they made in that book on combating violent extremism is that the threat assessment team should be looking at that as an issue that they should be examining. So in closing, let me make two things. First of all, I really applaud the efforts, and I say that sincerely, because Oregon is unique. It really is a unique setting. You know, you're one of the few states in the country who have embraced this at the statewide level and say, hey, we want to move forward with this. So I want to thank the committee, the entire legislature, the State Education Agency, the governor, the School Safety Committee, Salem Kaiser for the work they've done, and to say that this group can serve as a model for the rest of the country. Also, I want to applaud the lines, the tip line, is because again, that's something which has not used in a lot of places, which is absolutely vital, and the system that you're using has demonstrated to be very effective. So thank you for that. Secondly, and lastly, I want to emphasize that threat assessment is not the answer to school safety. It's not the answer to school safety. But it's an integral and essential part of any school safety partnership. So what I'm not saying is that that's the only thing we have to do in schools is a threat assessment team. It's not. But it has to be part of a larger component, comprehensive, multidisciplinary structure to really identify kids who are on the pathway to hurting themselves or others. And it's a process that basically, if done properly, could save lives. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Representative Greenwood, please.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And my question may be better addressed to the next panel, but let me raise it. As a part of my job, I tend to visit schools around my district and outside the district. And I find them appallingly open. I visited a grade school that had five open doors in a neighborhood that was not the best neighborhood in town. It had no internal television, so if somebody showed up, they wouldn't be able to know what was going on. Do you include in threat assessment the physical security of the buildings as a part of the threat assessment?
No, I think it's part of a larger process. I mean, the Department of Education has a program called Readiness for Emergency Management for Schools, which is a technical assistance center for which Bronwyn Roberts, who's just sitting in the back, represents. And that's an assessment. That's an on-site assessment, you know, to see whether or not the doors are locked, entry is limited to certain people. That's not part of threat assessment. That is a more of a physical comprehensive review of the site.
Maybe some later witnesses can speak to that.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for you. I know that I teach at a community college at Mount Hood, unfortunately not Clackamas, but at any rate, we have been going through an ongoing active shooter sort of thing where we do drills and things like that. So there is some of that. I noticed that this is PK to 12. Is there a companion piece that addresses community colleges and higher education?
The short answer is yes. After the shooting in Virginia Tech, we helped sponsor the development of a threat assessment guide for higher ed. As you know, I mean, higher ed is quite different than the number of buildings, the number of people, the facilities that they have there. It's a little village, so it's much more complicated than what we do in K through 12. You know, it's also the number of people who come on to to whether it's a community college or a higher, you know, so you have to keep track of a lot of different things. But yet there is a process, and I'd be more than happy to forward you or at least the URL of that threat assessment guide that was developed for Virginia Tech.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Extremely helpful. And I appreciate it a lot. You said something, not that you said it bothered me, but the concept bothers me, and you used the term, not when you were building a profile, but finding commonalities among suspects, and that was felt bullied.
No, they're two separate issues. Bullying is one, and the no profiles is a separate issue.
Right. So when you use the term felt bullied, instantly I went, oh, my gosh, what can actually be bullying, and then a person interpreting that as bullying can be a little hard sometimes to identify. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I don't know if I'm being clear yet.
Well, sure. First of all, let me say is that this was a we don't say in the report that this is causal. So there's no way that we say is because somebody was bullied, they basically went on a school shooting. So there's no evidence that was causal. Matter of fact, in all of these cases, there's so many other factors that are involved that we can't tease one out. But we also know at the same time is that I think it was around 75% of the kids said they were bullied. And so, you know, when you do a study like we did, which was a case study going back and looking at 41 cases, 41 individuals, sometimes you had to rely on investigative files, which were incomplete, especially if the offender committed suicide. So case closed and there wasn't a deep investigation on it. At other times, it never even came up in the trial, for example, but it came up after the trial and somebody said that they were bullied. And the extent of bullying really ranged. I mean, there was no single that you could say, you know, it was persistent. I mean, many of them, where we saw it, many people say that bullying was persistent, occurred over time, and was causing them, how should I put it, to change their behaviors. In other words, miss school, skip classes, and do things like that. But part of the problem with looking at and doing this type of research is that the information is not always there. So you don't have 41 complete cases. And so and you got to be very careful how you do that. So the no profile, that's simpler because you could just say how many. The only profile that we had there, which was proved to be wrong at the end, and we always said that, was that in our survey they were all boys. And it wasn't until 6 months after we closed the study that there was a young lady who engaged in a targeted attack.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sheriff Roberts.
Yes. If I could just bring up our next two individuals, Sergeant Kevin McDonald and Dr. Dave Novotny.
Hey, thank you.
Good afternoon, Representative Barker and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me be here today. My name is Kevin McDonald. I'm police sergeant for Beaverton Police Department. I supervise the school resource officer team at the Beaverton Police Department. And I just wanted to present some case studies that we've had within our district to kind of give you an idea of student threat assessment and how that process works. These cases are fortunately success cases. John P., and the names have been changed, so don't worry about that. In early April, John made threats via text to another student. John said that he was going to kill everyone at the school and then himself. John also made similar threats via social media. John was familiar with firearms as he had gone shooting with his family. He had access to a Glock handgun, an AR-15 rifle, and a shotgun. John posted on social media a picture of himself actually holding a firearm. During the interview of John and subsequent search of a backpack, an ice pick was found in his backpack. He described himself as occasionally feeling suicidal. Most of you have probably never heard of John or this story. Paul M. as a middle school student, studied the Columbine High School incident extensively. It wasn't until Paul, as a freshman in high school, was seen in class by another student on his iPod looking at numerous photos of the Columbine shooting incident. The alarmed student fortunately came forward and reported Paul to school administrators. The investigation revealed that Paul had attempted suicide several times. Paul was fixated on three love interests at the school that were not reciprocal towards him. Paul also joined social media groups that supported the Columbine High School shooting incident and would regularly post about killing people. Paul had gone as far as to solicit others online to obtain a firearm. Paul had a journal referencing shooting others for revenge. Paul also used the initials NBK on his jacket, which he wore, that stood for, in his words, natural born killers. No one has ever heard of Paul other than our investigation. The third student that I have a profile of is Trent D. Trent caught the attention of school administrators when they received a tip from a student that Trent had a kill list. The school administrator found a large stack of drawings and of notebook paper in Trent's possession. The stack of papers depicted violent acts that he wanted to kill people, and he would periodically review it. The list included people that had bullied him, didn't care enough about him. Trent was familiar with firearms and had gone shooting with his uncle. He had access to firearms in the house. When Trent's parents were contacted and officers looked at his room in his house, he had access to thousands of rounds of ammunition and firearms in the household. Trent reported feeling isolated and often thought about killing himself. None of these students ever made headlines. No one was harmed. Why? Student threat assessment. These are some examples of students in the district that I work with. These instances aren't unique to the district. This happens in every district around the state. There's no perfect plan to eliminate these threats of violent acts. What we can do is try to reduce them and change the pathway to violence as a community. Student threat assessment changes a pathway and builds stronger connections for students who feel alienated. Is a community effort to change this. The Oregon School Safety Task Force has worked extremely hard over the past few years to find the most suitable solution to reduce large-scale violence in our school systems. The tip line is a great start for that. Student threat assessment is that other piece. So what happened to John H.? John H. is currently a sophomore at an alternative high school and has no further incidents. Paul E. is currently a junior, attends a high school, and again, no further incidents. Trent D. is currently a senior and is scheduled to graduate this year. In closing, please consider student threat assessment as a viable option to identify these targeted threats of violence. That's all I have. Thank you.
So next, I'd like to introduce Dr. Dave Novotny to provide information on the proposed statewide student threat assessment system for us.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Novotny, and I work as the superintendent of the Willamette Education Service District. I'm appearing today as vice chair of the Oregon Task Force on School Safety to talk about the importance of creating a statewide student threat assessment system for Oregon schools. Currently, as you may know, in our state, some schools have a student threat assessment system in place, but most do not. In my education service district region, 19 school districts utilize a model that is developed or was developed by the Salem-Keizer School District, and it's considered to be an exemplar of student threat assessment in the state of Oregon. The 19 school districts in my region, Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties, have found the system to be extremely beneficial as far as intervening early in the lives of students who are showing signs of potential violence or self-harm. Members of the Mid-Valley Student Threat Assessment Team, The team that supports the 19 school districts in my region have developed a short 3-minute video offering their professional perspective on the importance of establishing a student threat assessment system for Oregon schools. It's short, once again, just 3 minutes, and I'd like to show that video to you.
Kids are different these days. They're growing up faster with the presence of the internet and social media. They're exposed to so many more things, and there's so much more violence.
Salem Kaiser and Mid Valley youth are facing an increase of threats and problems due to rapidly changing technology, social media threats, and an increase in the sensationalization of violent rampage attacks directed at schools and communities.
Each time a story hits a headline, it affects families across the nation, not just where it happens. Students can be afraid to go to school, parents afraid to send their students to school, teachers are concerned about could it happen here.
If teachers and students are too fearful to learn and teach, that has a profound impact on the community. By following the key elements, early identification, assessment, early intervention, and ongoing support, dangerous and problematic behavior can be addressed and eliminated.
In the acts of targeted violence that we've studied, there's always some what we call leakage. They usually put out, while they're on that path to targeted violence, the fact that they're on that path. And if you could recognize those things, you can prevent them.
Salem Kaiser School District, the Willamette Education Service District, and a number of other school districts from the state use this system and have experienced improved safety and an increase in their resources necessary for intervention.
We're all speaking the same language. We're all following the same protocol. We have all those partners putting their resources and ability and information together. We're providing psychological safety and security for every student, parent, and staff member throughout the school. We're seeing everybody working together to make our school safer.
Members of the Oregon Task Force on School Safety believe that all Oregon schools need access to the additional layer of protection provided by a well-conceived student threat assessment program. I would like to be able to share a little bit. I'm sorry if we need to advance one more slide if we can. One more. There we go. Thank you. The system that we envision for the state of Oregon would really establish multiple regions across the state with one or more regional threat assessment specialists designated to support each of those individual regions. System staffing would consist of one program administrator. At the very top of the organizational chart, you can see that the Oregon Department of Education would oversee this particular program. And then there would be 14 FTE that would be regional threat assessment specialists located in various regions across the state of Oregon. If you're in the Multnomah area where there's high density population, there might be several regional threat assessment specialists. And if you're in Eastern Oregon, where the student population is much more sparse, there may be a 0.5 FTE specialist. But we're trying to find a way to make sure that there's equitable support across the entire state. We envision that there would be a steering committee to help guide this program. As you know, this is a highly specialized field, and there's not that many people in the state of Oregon who are experienced in student threat assessment. We think a steering committee of 6 to 8 individuals to help guide the program in its development would be a wise concept for us to consider. The 14 regional threat assessment specialists would be basically stationed at various education service districts, because we already have 19 education service districts that cover the entire state of Oregon. So we have that backbone organization that could support this type of service. Really, the role of the regional threat assessment specialist would be to do multiple things. Obviously, first and foremost is to provide training and standardized level one protocols for the staff in that region. In threat assessment, the Salem-Keizer model, there is a two-tier approach. Level one is really the site-based or school-based type of approach, where you have a school person, such as a school administrator or a school counselor, a law enforcement person, and then a mental health specialist that can do the level one screening for any student that presents potential risk of violence or self-harm. The next phase, obviously, would be they could consult with school and community-based threat assessment teams, and then they could coordinate the level two protocols, deploying multidisciplinary teams to schools to assess risk and assist in identifying supports and interventions. The level two protocol would be the community-based team that could support individual schools, school districts. They would also serve as representatives on regional multi-agency threat assessment teams to review the level two assessments. They would provide supervision strategies for students who are in at-risk situations, and help connect students and families with community-based services and related supports. And I think important, and we've heard this from Mr. Moduleski, ensure program fidelity, because we want to do this the right way. The proposed budget for a program of this nature, the annual budget, as you can see where it says total, is a little over $2 million. So the biennial budget would be $4.1 million for the next 2 years. The members of the Oregon Task Force on School Safety, though, really see this as an investment. When you take a look at the cost of tragic events, we can talk about Umpqua Community College as one example. In talking to their Board of Trustees president, the cost, the actual physical cost, is over $8 million just to recover from that particular event. And that obviously does not include the human costs and the trauma that's caused by those type of events. The statewide school safety tip line, Oregon Safe, the system superintendent Hapton discussed earlier, serves as an excellent early warning notification system, or early warning system, for school administrators. Establishing a statewide student threat assessment system will help school personnel across the state to effectively respond to threats of aggression and suicide risk. So the statewide tip line is early warning, early notification system, and the student threat assessment system is really the early identification, assessment, and early intervention of at-risk students, and then providing wraparound supports to support the student and the student's family. In the documents that were submitted, we do have an informational flyer that we've produced for your review. It's a two-sided document that gives you a little bit more information about the statewide system. And with that, I'll go ahead and wrap up my presentation, and thank you for the opportunity to share information with you this afternoon.
And just a couple closing comments, Chair Barker. One of the things I can't emphasize enough is just that these issues, as you've heard today, are extremely complex. And I think one of the things that happens across the state of Oregon is these complex issues are oftentimes, the decisions are being made by just a couple people, and sometimes even an individual person. And really our philosophy on trying to come up with great recommendations on really complex issues is really getting the right people around the table. One of the most powerful things that I've
benefited from is having representatives from mental health here, because they bring a whole different perspective than law enforcement and really make a well-rounded team. And the concept is relatively simple. It's a multidisciplinary approach to assess those threats, come up with the best recommendations, and our goal is to prevent future harm, but also self-harm. And I think many of you know the tragic statistics in the state of Oregon is really completely, in my position, out of control. And I know Representative Olson, Representative Barker, with your past experience, you've responded to suicides such as myself. And you see that firsthand impact on families and communities. And I always ask myself, is there something we could have done to hopefully prevent that? And our recommendation is there is, and it's bringing people to the table to come up with the best plan. So with that, I'll close and open it up for any kind of questions.
Questions, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sergeant, thank you for your case studies.
Thank you.
And sharing those with us. You commented a couple times, and I'm sure it occurred in every single case, that students came forward and told someone. What does that look like? I have a hard time believing they're knocking on the principal's door saying, I got information. So what's the mechanism they're using? Is it technology?
There's different ways that comes about. Social media, certainly. Sometimes we find threats that are posted. Someone sees it and reports it. We've really pushed the see something, say something in our district. Sometimes students are comfortable enough with the school resource officer at the school. They'll come up to them directly. Sometimes they'll just mention it to the teacher, hey, so-and-so did this, and the teacher will start the chain. So it really varies. I don't know if it's consistently the same. I know having the accessibility of the statewide tip line certainly is going to make that much easier for students who may have knowledge of something and really get that ball rolling to, you know, identify a person who is considering either suicide or harming someone at school.
Thank you.
Questions? I just would say I received some concerns from some mental health people, and so I drafted a letter and I've sent it to the superintendent so you can review it and see if we can fix that. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your testimony today. It's good information. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Greenlight.
What happened to those three kids? How were they treated?
With student threat assessment, we will review the case to make sure that the safety plan that is developed is being followed, and that if any changes or modifications need to be made to that. The majority of the cases, in these three cases, they followed the safety plan. These kids all were able to get off a pathway of violence. And it's a community effort. It's mental health. It's sometimes DHS. Sometimes it's the juvenile department. Sometimes it's finding a staff member at the school that can connect with that individual. And in all three of these cases, I can think of, well, at least in two of them for sure, sometimes a different educational setting works for them, so they get off of the path of violence.
They moved into a different school?
Sometimes a specialized school. Sometimes there's learning issues combined with their behavior, too. And sometimes it's just a matter of finding that extra support for the child to get off of that path.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead. We'll be back.
As I was listening to your response to Representative Greenlick's question, I didn't hear parent in there anywhere. Tell me how that factors in.
That's absolutely instrumental in having the parent involvement. And that's maybe something I didn't talk about in any of these, but the parent involvement, we will bring them in. We will find out what can we do to help you as a parent, what can we do to help you, with your child. What are the child's strengths? What are the weaknesses? What's missing, and sometimes parents aren't always aware of resources that are available to them, and this is an opportunity where, as we come together as a multidisciplinary group, that someone from mental health can say, no, we have wraparound services that you're eligible for. So the parents by no means are excluded from any of this. Matter of fact, they are integral to making this process successful.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that brings something up. many of the details that you gave us, you didn't give us all the details, of course, I understand that, but many of the details we saw and that you gave us, some may be criminal behavior and some may not. That's scary behavior that could lead to something, but that's not a crime. And so I'm wondering how you could, thinking back when I would respond to schools or deal with kids and there'd be this kind of an issue, and really the philosophy was unless they broke the law, you don't have a mechanism to do anything. So what I'm getting at is if they weren't convicted, if they weren't charged with a crime, my guess is maybe some of those weren't, how were you able to bring resources? Was it all the parental piece saying, yeah, we have a problem and we want you? Because you can't just jump in without some level of cause.
So with the, you're correct, not all these cases are a criminal path. Matter of fact, the majority of them probably aren't. And that's where the multidisciplinary piece comes in. Law enforcement certainly is at the table, but we aren't necessarily the driving force. A lot of times it is mental health. A lot of times it is maybe the juvenile department. Maybe they are on probation for something else. And finding services that are going to work for that student. So it's not just one path necessarily. It could be any different path, and sometimes it's with some of these students we identify that maybe there's some learning issues that was the root cause of the behavior. The cases that I showed you certainly are extreme, and by no means are representative of everything that we deal with. In the last year we've had about 88 assessments, and only 10 of those were maybe more serious, similar to these, or maybe slightly lesser. So again, these are some extreme examples, but any one of these is a tragic event in our state.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gorsuch, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To go back, Sergeant, to what you were talking about, the one problem that I see with that is the multidisciplinary approach is excellent and I think catches a lot of things that just law enforcement would not. But in my area, which is East Multnomah County, we have the Reynolds School District, which has extreme poverty. And so the services for the poor kind of dovetail with this, but we have a lot of unmet need when it comes to those services, and many times we have parents that are maybe working more than one job. There may be one person in the household, maybe two. So it's, I mean, that adds to the complexity of all of this, I would think.
Certainly. You know, I guess the best answer for that is we try to find the best resources that are available for the situation, and many times the schools bear the burden of that, whether it's staff to assist, but it is a community approach to figure out a solution that's viable. With many of these cases, a simple plan of action for the student when they, you know, show up to school, they maybe they get their backpack searched for a period of time because they had said they were going to bring a weapon, and they have someone, staff member, check in with them daily, or you know, a couple times a day. That support, that extra person in the community reaching out to them, makes a world of difference to these students because they find someone that cares for them and is interested in what's going on in their life. And when you have multiple community members, whether it is juvenile department, whether it is mental health, whether it's DHS, whether it's law enforcement, the school resource officer, checking in with this kid who has said they were gonna be violent, they realize, oh, wait a minute, people do care about me. People are seeing what I do, and they are way more likely, or way less likely, I should say, to follow the path that they were starting down.
Quick follow-up,
please.
And in fact, what you are getting to is also the importance of volunteers like mentors.
or big brother, big sister, because I totally agree with you that many times these kids have no one that they can turn to that they think cares about them. So I think, you know, the more we can also bring in those groups that can do the mentoring piece where the school may not have the resources, that could be a good connection with all of this if it's not already there.
Certainly. Agreed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Post. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Greenlick, when he asked about the three cases, it just made me think of something while you were talking. And anybody can answer this. You said we wouldn't know about this, or I forget how you said it, or we never knew about this, or something like that.
Not publicized other than the people that know about the threat. Yeah.
And it just occurred to me, a lot of times we have bills here that we see that are a deterrent bill. We had one yesterday. So the idea is to deter this from ever happening. And I got to thinking, we're talking kids here, so I want to be really careful. But could it be possible that by actually making it public and making it letting the media know, I'm just help think with me here a little bit. I'm trying to wonder if there's a way of deterring future incidents by publicizing that, you know, hey, look what happened. We cracked down on these three, or we found these three, and kids are reporting each other now, and it's a new day. You know what I mean? I'm always thinking media, how to use media to my advantage, and I think that you can.
And if I might comment on that, I had the opportunity to go to Texas State University to a program called Alert, and they actually researched all the shootings and situations across the country. And I literally came away from that recognizing some errors we actually made in the town center. And one of the things is that we in public safety need to do everything within our power to refrain from naming these shooters. And one of the things is because it really has unfortunately inspired other people to really be recognized. While I totally understand that, it was completely a recommendation. For example, Reynolds, when I was there, please don't name the shooter or only do it once. Umpqua do the very same thing, because in our situation, even at the Clackamas Town Center, we had immediately after that individuals that were threatening to do harm within schools. And so, unfortunately, some of those individuals that are stable, I think it can be very dangerous. But I mean, it could be something we could research a little more. But
let me rephrase. Is that okay? So, what? Not the shooters. Not the incident. Of course, I agree with you 100%. I'm talking about the three cases that we wouldn't have known about if you hadn't talked about us today. Is using the media to say we prevented this from happening because kids reported it. Hey, kids. Report. Turn the narrative around so the kids are now buzzing on each other's cell phones. You know what? I heard Bobby saying something pretty bad the other day. Maybe we should report. And I know they're doing that now, but I'm trying to think, how do we twist the media to use them to our advantage on this to perhaps deter? I don't know. Just crazy thing I was just thinking of. I don't want to bring attention to them. Don't get me wrong.
I understand. No, sorry.
No way.
Okay, thank you, Representative. And then I'll just mention the bill that was referred to is Senate Bill 414. It's in Senate Education Committee, and then it'll go to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and then it'll go down to Joint Ways and Means. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll close the informational hearing. Public hearing on House Bill 2638.
So, Mr. Chair, I'll just kind of walk through it here a little bit. Shannon's going to help me too. I don't know if we have others that are going to talk about it or not. But House Bill 2638 is obviously a committee bill. It's a bill that started actually with a conversation with Representative Greenlick and I well over a year ago. But our concern was dealing with IIDs, ignition interlock devices. We kind of felt like there was not a consistency with the quality of the equipment. We didn't think there was consistency with installation. We even had a problem with accountability and also just the reporting mechanism. So you got Troy. That's good. It's about time you showed up, sir. Okay. So, but, you know, one thing led to another, and we ended up putting together a big work group. And we met several different times. It was interesting. We had two former Washington State Patrol troopers that were down, and they're involved with Smart Start program up there, which is a mechanism to actually, Well, I'm back up here. They WSP has moved way out in front of this whole issue on the IIDs, and actually they control the operation of it and oversight of it now up there. But Smart Start's one of those mechanisms that provides safety equipment supplies. And that's where we were wanting to go with this. I can walk through the bill just a little bit with you. It's very simple. The first part, Section 2's definitions. And what you'll see, Sections 2 through 6 identify the service providers. That's where we really were wanting to go with this. And I think, Troy, you're going to kind of go into more detail.
Mr. Chair, Troy Costales, Safety Division Administrator of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Vice Chair Olson, yes, I can add to your overview once you're through.
Okay, we might be bouncing back and forth here then. I'll let you continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Troy Costales, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to House Bill 2638. Vice Chair Olson done a great job of teeing up the conversation. Representative Greenlick as well, thank you for being part of the interlock work group during the interim time. The interlock device system in Oregon is in need of improvement. There are multiple things that we can approach in order to help those that have been convicted related to driving under the influence of intoxicants, and the device that's installed in the vehicles that they operate helps them be able to stay clean and sober when behind the wheel, protecting all of us that are around them on the transportation system. This bill outlines some authority and is given to the Oregon Department of Transportation, and at this point in time that is intended then to go to the Safety Division within my part of the organization in order to establish the program related to the vendors and the installers of these devices and the expectations of them as companies and businesses when they put these devices in individuals' vehicles. But then at a certain time in the future that this entire program that we've stood up then shifts to the Oregon State Police, which is later on in the bill as you have before you. As Representative Olson commented, Oregon was at one point in time out in front. In the late 80s, we were one of the first states to start to use the devices for these individuals. But over time, our leadership has dwindled, and the organization of the process, the program, has become a bit fractured. And now Washington State is out in front of the pack, and they are establishing best practices and also some of the administrative oversight. And that's where this particular bill aims. The goal of the bill is so that the devices used by the offenders, that the courts can rely on this, the offenders themselves can rely on the devices, treatment providers and society at large all see an improvement because there's oversight related to what is installed in the vehicles. Legislature has made changes over the years, including just a couple years ago, about anybody that goes through DUI diversion, that they are to have this device installed on their vehicle, and it's an extension of treatment, is to help that individual become used to being sober when behind the wheel, to make those smart choices when they are going to operate a motor vehicle. The primary impact of this bill is giving ODOT the authority and some broad rule authority to establish what those standards are related to the vendors and the installers around the state, and in turn also to set up a fee structure so those companies pay in to be able to have a quality assurance program for themselves. This is something that is common. It is used in Washington State, and that is what the authority and instruction to ODOT would be. There would be staff need to start this up. This isn't something we do now. It would be new work. Some of the responsibilities would be to work with the 13 vendors that are in the state with 100 different installation locations around the state, and also the dozens of different devices that are available. And do those devices, are they installed? Are they checked? Is the setting, calibration of the device when put in the car accurate? And every 60 days, is that being checked so that the individual behind the wheel is being monitored accurately according to the design plan that the court has put forward? Education and outreach to law enforcement, what's the device look like? How's it work? To courts, what can the judge be able to expect out of the device? Related to prosecutors and the individuals themselves, what's the device look like? How does it operate? How do they use it? The rules process to follow what the bill has set is likely to be a little longer than the timeline that the bill creates. Appreciate the committee's high expectations and expediency behind this bill. The reality of on the executive branch side to go through the process, particularly around fees, which generates quite a bit of commentary, and the fact that we want to do this statewide. The timing may be just a request that we've got as to looking at when some of the due dates are in order to follow the appropriate administrative process related to rules, because we do want to involve those stakeholders. But, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, committee members, I'd let you know that my office and the Oregon Department of Transportation stands ready to take on this responsibility should this bill move forward and we're given the adequate authority and resources to be able to put this in play. As I mentioned, there are multiple things within the interlock device system and how it affects the impaired driving countermeasure program. But this is one very positive step forward related to what we can do. It's something we can achieve from a peer review point of view, and we have some great resources in the state of Washington that you've heard from that we can rely on in order to help us move forward in order to attack the problem of impaired driving in the state of Oregon. And, Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to continue to answer questions or be able to add to Representative Olson's presentation.
Okay, so I just want to follow up, too, with what Troy just said. There is somewhat of an investment for us from the legislature, and it's in Section 6, deals with the IID Management Fund, and there's a couple mechanisms, as he just described, too, about where the fees would go. So, and it's kind of like Chana said the other day, there is a pay-to-play type connection here for all the service providers. Because we're serious about the impaired driver out there, that they would really behoove us, I think, to invest into this to some degree. I appreciate all the efforts that your agency is going to have with crafting the rules on this. I can't believe you think you need more time. I get that. But come January of 2019, it shifts from the Department of Transportation over to the state police. And that's kind of where we've been wanting to go. But clearly your agency, Troy, is going to be the front runner on this and, setting the tone for it.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, yes, sir.
I'd like to make a comment, if I may, Mr. Chair. I've been distressed. I was interested in working on this group because I've been very distressed with the repeat offenses of people who are convicted of driving under the influence. You suspend their license, and then they drive anyway. They end up getting arrested again. They end up killing people. It's a big problem. One of the advantages of having an effective interlock device system is that you can change the way you deal with the impaired driver. The question is, all right, you want to continue your life. You want to keep driving, you need to keep driving to go to work, fine, but it's going to be with an IED. IED. Mm-hmm. IED, something different.
Yeah. IED.
Yeah. So I think, but in order to begin to move in that direction, we need to have had a system that was reliable and that actually worked, which in fact we did not have beforehand. So people would end up going somewhere, their car getting stopped because the IID screws up and there's nobody there to take care of them, or we don't really have confidence that the reports are being made of violations. This is, as I see, not the answer to the problem. It's the first step to dealing with the problem. It's a necessary step and an important one.
Thank you. Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenlick spoke a little bit to the point I wanted to make, which is, I have struggled with IID bills in this committee in the past, partially because we had no rules around them, and we were the dumping ground for equipment that no other state would take. Mm-hmm. And so we also only had installation in the valley. So if you were out in Eastern Oregon and had to get an IID, you were out of luck.
That's right.
So I'm happy to see a conversation around certification, and it looks like we'll have more facilities statewide potentially under this bill. But it is something that I want to we need to continue to work on, because they are a very helpful tool in managing intoxicated drivers. But if you are working your program and you can't get to work because your IID doesn't work, there's a real problem. And so I'm happy to see this bill. and that I don't have to argue about an IID bill again. I also want to make sure to put on the record that as we look at fees, that nothing out of the intoxicated driver fund that flows to treatment is impacted by this bill, and that we make sure that we're holding harmless those dollars. I don't pretend to understand how they all flow, but I do know that some of them come from there. So I want to put on the record that, you know, we need to keep every dollar into treatment that we can keep in treatment. And if this bill impacts that at all, then I will be back to having concerns with an IID bill. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we've, one of the things too is the fees will cover the indigent as well. You know,
yeah.
the people who can pay will pay a little bit extra, so that those who can't will still have it. And one of the things we've heard testimony from people who have been suspended for long periods of time, or even early on, where they can't get to their job. This will allow them, their license might be suspended, but they could drive with the IID and
right. No, and that's great. I just want to make sure they work,
yeah.
which has been the
yeah.
problem in the
and
past.
In the things we've looked at,
yeah.
so they would be
so.
Serviced around the state, close by, and they, I think in, up there they contracted with maybe Best Buy or somebody, car toys, and they train a technician. The technician has to be certified, and then
right.
they can check those so that the driver who's a ways away from the metro area can get his checked and fixed in a timely manner.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to see not just sideboards, but a tightening of this program. A brief anecdotal story. Actually, a friend of mine that known her husband since I was a kid and family friends of ours, and she's had, I don't know, three or four DUIs, one at least as a result of a wreck, and she was always supposed to get an interlock device installed in her car. She never did, and it wasn't an issue. And it's quite frustrating for some of us. And so the device can only be as good as the program
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and the enforcement of it. The device was clearly useless in her case.
Thank
clearly.
You. And that's why we've been waiting to do it. And I also want to give a little extra thanks to Representative Olson and Greenlick for working on this trend to bring this package together. Yes, Jenna, please.
Chair Berger, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, I want to put on three points that we haven't discussed yet that I want to just bring to your attention. And these are related to the court process and how this bill might improve the court process. One, it requires installers to testify, to agree to testify. Apparently, this has been a problem at times where providers will say, well, no, you can... You can drag me into court to testify right now. I'm not going to. So this, you have to sign up on the front end in order to get your certification to testify about the installation, the calibration, and the negative reports. It also requires a GPS location data point be taken when a person has a test violation. So if they blow into it and it's over the amount, it takes a snapshot of where the person is, and this will help prove the venue when they come back into court to talk about why they're potentially driving when they shouldn't be. And third, it allows courts to return a person to treatment when they're in diversion and they have at least two negative reports.
Thank you very much, Troy.
Can I ask one more question? Okay,
yes.
The second point, the GPS. I didn't hear all of you really well.
It's to establish venue. So when you go to court,
right.
if I arrest you, you have to be able to say it happened in the county of Multnomah.
That's right.
County
this,
of Marion.
This place, this time. This location.
And they had a case in Washington where somebody had the, I think the girlfriend blew, the pictures taken, and they said, yes, we did it. We were drinking. We were in King County. We admit it. Here's where we were. They go to court, and the judge says, that's not good enough. You have to prove where they were,
mm-hmm.
not just on their word. So this the GPS marks where they, any violation would take place.
Okay, only because I have so many tinfoil hat wearing friends.
Yeah. We're gonna, yeah. No.
Is that one scary to anybody at all?
As long as they don't get drive drunk, they don't ever have to worry about it.
Well, yeah. No kidding.
Or otherwise the case is thrown out on a technicality.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm in agreement. That's pretty cool technology. Wow.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Troy, for coming in.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, committee. We stand adjourned. Thank you very much, Troy, for coming in.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, committee. We stand adjourned. Well, thank you.